The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Yesterday, we talked some about the importance of silence or solitary time. I put together some of that material in the Trumpet Brief last night as well. And so when you see stories like from today in the news stack about how many hours and hours and hours people spend with television, you won't believe it, how much time we spend with the TV over the course of a lifetime. On average, we'll come to that later on in the show. And also, we'll have another Bible study, I guess you could call it, brought to you today by The Atlantic, the left-wing Atlantic. Did I really say that? A Bible study coming from The Atlantic? Yes, indeed. You'll see what I mean here in just a moment. Well, the Ukraine President Zelensky, he has said again in yet another interview that there was no quid pro quo. He has said it over and over again. He told Time magazine, look, I never talk to the president from the position of a quid pro quo. That's not my thing. I don't want us to look like beggars. There was nothing like that that happened. And of course, if you're the mainstream media, he's lying. He has to be lying because there is a quid pro quo. Donald Trump did muscle his way into forcing this president to investigate Joe Biden, which of course never happened. But he has to be lying if their narrative is to be believed. The President Trump said on Twitter, if the radical left Democrats were sane, which they are not, it would be case over. That would be the end of this. If they were sane, this would be over. Now, there are some reports, actually, that suggest that maybe the Democrats are looking for a way out. But then there's also those that are pushing for this to get done before the holidays later this month. In any event, there's a story in the New York Times here about the Attorney General, how that he's evidently calling into question some of the conclusions in the Inspector General's report, which is due to come out, I guess, next week, next Monday, I believe it is. Here's the New York Times take. It says, if the Attorney General rebuts the finding that the FBI had sufficient cause to open the investigation, the president's allies could use his skepticism to dismiss the entire report. Well, they could say this is biased. The president's allies, says Attorney General William Barr, has told Justice Department officials that he's skeptical of a conclusion by the department's inspector general, Horowitz. He's appointed by Obama, by the way, President Obama. But it says he's skeptical, Attorney General Barr is, of a conclusion by the department's IG that the FBI had sufficient information to open the investigation into whether Trump associates conspired with Russia during the 2016 presidential race. It says further on, Mr. Barr's doubts are significant because they could be perceived as the nation's top law enforcement officer siding with Mr. Trump. Well, imagine that. The Attorney General siding with the president. It says, Mr. Trump, who has long cast doubt on the legitimacy of the Russia investigation over law enforcement officials. Of course, the Times has no problem when it's President Obama's wingman, Eric Holder. That's the way he saw himself in that office of AG. He was the president's wingman. He was the president's assistant. He was right in step with the president. And the major media, of course, they expect this when they're all Democrats. But when it's a Republican in office, well, the attorney general certainly can't agree with Donald Trump. That would indicate bias. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out with the IG report coming out Monday, and I guess Horowitz testifying a day or two later. And then who knows when the main report, or the one that could cause the most damage as far as the radical left is concerned, that would be Mr. Durham, his investigation. And I don't think we have an estimation on when that one will be complete, but it is a criminal probe, as we learned a few months ago. Here in the UK, there's still more about the stunning fall of Prince Andrew. This headline from Fox News, actually. Virginia Roberts, she was interviewed on BBC last night. This is one of the supposed victims of this sex trafficking case brought on by Jeffrey Epstein, who died under mysterious circumstances while in prison. And of course, Prince Andrew was reeled into this scandal, this sex scandal. And so here comes Virginia Roberts. She was a teenager at the time of the alleged incident, and she's coming back almost 20 years later, talking to the BBC about this this scandal. Here's a little bit of a montage of last night's interview, clip one.
I implore the citizens in the UK to stand up beside me, to help me fight this fight, to not accept this as being okay. This is not some sordid sex story. This is a story of being trafficked. This is a story of abuse. And this is a story of your guys's royalty. How in the highest levels of the government and powerful people were allowing this to happen, not only allowing it to happen, but participating in it. I just didn't expect it from royalty. I didn't expect it from someone that people look up to and admire, you know, in the royal family.
Now, we don't know how much of this is true, and really there's not a lot of new information with this woman's interview last night. Her story's already been out there in print media, but it's just another stain on the royal family. There she was on BBC again saying that, look, it goes right up to the highest levels of Britain's royal family. And of course, this interview follows just a couple of weeks after Prince Andrew himself, his disastrous interview and the massive backlash that followed, and how that he's basically been forced to back out of public life. The press, they see it as him essentially being sacked from his duties, his responsibilities in the royal family. A friend of his said, the Queen summoned the Duke to Buckingham Palace to tell him her decision. It was a devastating moment for both of them. His reputation is in tatters. It is unlikely he will ever perform royal duties again. He is disgraced. And so, as I say, yet another stain on this royal family. Richard was saying that he's no longer going to receive the sovereign grant allowance. That's the money to pay for his official duties and upkeep, that sort of thing. I think he'll be all right financially, but still, this according to one royal author who said, this is absolutely unprecedented, the correction that was meted out against Prince Andrew, that is, unprecedented that a fairly senior member of the royal family should be forced to retire from public life. I would think the Queen is horrified. What must the Queen be thinking? One scandal after another, one embarrassing interview after another, and then all these projects this prince was involved in, the many charities, and so on. As I say, it's been quite a hot topic here in the UK. And the reason, of course, that we keep our eye on it is because of statements my father's made about the Stone of Destiny being moved to Scotland back in the 1990s. And then, of course, all the scandals more recently with the royal family. But speaking of the stone, moving the stone from London, from London to Scotland, it was Prince Andrew who presided over the handover. He was up in Scotland, in Edinburgh Castle, handing the stone over to Scottish authorities. This happened back in 1996. You can hear the prince on this next soundbite, but if you're watching the video stream, you see the ceremony or the handover right at the end as he gives the Scottish official the document or whatever it was to signify this transfer. This is clip two.
I now therefore, on behalf of Her Majesty the Queen, place the Stone of Scone in the care of you, the commissioners for the keeping of the regalia of Scotland.
This is Prince Andrew here, placing the care of the stone. He's presenting some official document over to this Scottish official. You can see the video, as I say. Pretty amazing. He was there on behalf of the Queen to hand over this historic stone, this stone that goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. If you know the history, when that stone was transferred, this is what my father said in the Trumpet magazine. This is August of 1996. He said, "I believe this stone is the most precious physical thing on this earth. I also believe that Queen Elizabeth just made the worst decision of her life. And the British government has made the biggest mistake in its history. It says England's actions have scorned the omnipotent living God. And there's going to be a terrifying penalty unless they repent." Now you look at what's happened since that transfer, including to the man that was right there as the official handing it over. The royal family official, Prince Andrew himself. More recently, my father in his book, The New Throne of David, well, he noted how that after the transfer, you had Princess Diana. She died in that horrible car accident or crash back in, I think it was 1997. But this is what my father writes in the New Throne book. It says, "Did the royal family of David's throne lose some of its protection from God?" When they lost the stone, that is, or didn't lose it, they gave it up. They gave it up. My father says, "I don't know for certain, but it's interesting that it happened within a year of England surrendering the stone. God does give special protection to those who have the throne of David. He also punishes them for their sins and more acutely, for their sins more acutely than he does others." I mean, this is important to God. Now, if you look at Prince Andrew's personal life, it really hasn't been that great for quite some time. He divorced his wife right around the time of that stone being moved. But we certainly have seen a precipitous decline in Britain's royal family over these past 20-some years, in particular over the past almost 3 years. In the New Throne book, my father says, "When God gave the revelation about the new stone on January 16th, 2017, the royal family of Britain was displaced as the royal family of David's throne. That was a signal of terrible things to come upon Britain, as well as a sharp decline of America and Judah. It was also an indication that we would see a rapid decline in Britain's royal family." A rapid decline in Britain's royal family. You think about that disastrous interview for the prince just a couple weeks ago, and commentators here in the UK calling it a turning point in British history. That's a rapid decline. That's what we're witnessing. just like my father wrote in the new throne of David. Well, speaking of the throne of David, Elliot Cohen at The Atlantic, he has a piece entitled, "He's No King David." Of course, he's referring to Donald Trump and how that some of Mr. Trump's supporters have taken to comparing the president to the biblical monarch. We needed Donald Trump to finally convince the radical left that there's some validity to the Old Testament prophets. How about that? Trump derangement syndrome, it's so strong that you now have left-wing commentators siding with the biblical prophets. Pretty amazing turn of events. You'll see at the end of this piece, I mean, this author, I assume he's Jewish. He's quoting from the Old Testament. He's talking even about burning or making sacrifices to pagan gods. It's astounding. Where were these articles 5, 6, 7 years ago? Well, you do have a number of the president's defenders comparing him not just to King David, but to, as we've pointed out before, quite a few biblical personalities. And now you have those coming from the left wing who are saying, well, now hang on a second, let's look into the Bible. How about that? It takes Donald Trump to get them to look into the Bible. The Atlantic, Elliot Cohen, he says, some avowedly pious men and women have, of late, explain their support of President Donald Trump by citing the example of King David, a sinner whom the Eternal used for his purposes and whose faults, crimes even, were redeemed by the good he did. It says, according to this line of thinking advanced by politicians, activists, and even clerics of different hues, Trump may have wandered far from the straight path, but he is nonetheless doing God's work. It says, those who invoke scripture to bolster the 45th president would do well to contemplate Nathan, the outraged herald of a piercing truth, rather than the sinner David. So this is The Atlantic saying, look, really, you ought to be focusing on the prophet Nathan, not King David, because Nathan is the one that delivered this strong warning message, these strong words of rebuke. Nathan's the one that delivered the correction from God. It says in the Hebrew Bible, and that, after all, is the text being invoked, the role of religious leaders is not to disregard sin, but to denounce it. Well, how about that? Well, that is one of a prophet's responsibilities, one of them, to denounce the sin. And then he gives some examples here. Take pervasive falsehood, for example. Falsehood, I should say. And then he gives quite a few statements from the Old Testament. And each man tricks his fellow, and truth they do not speak. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They are worn out from wrongdoing. Your dwelling is in the midst of deceit. And you get the message here. He's saying to these religious, these pious individuals who support the president, you shouldn't be justifying his sins. You should be saying he's a liar. He's lying. He's dwelling in the midst of deceit. It says, as Jeremiah writes, for these shall I not reckon with him, says the Eternal, for a nation like this shall I not be avenged? This is The Atlantic waxing eloquent from the Old Testament, of all places. Mr. Cohen says here, it is upon the powerful who oppress the defenseless, the widow, the orphan, and above all the stranger, that the Hebrew prophets pour out their rage. See, they want rage, like from the Hebrew prophets. They want rage directed at this president. And they're using the Hebrew prophets, the Old Testament prophets, as support for that. It says their proper focus is on the misdeeds of kings and priests, not not on making excuses for them, and they tell the elites of Jerusalem that it is their callousness toward the weak and defenseless, their lust for wealth, and their lies that will lead to the destruction of their city. This is astounding to me. An author, a journalist at The Atlantic, talking about the destruction of entire cities because of sin, because of rebellion, because of lies and deceit. It says, and formal piety of the kind displayed by the president's religious apologists cannot redeem such offenses, for God declares, I hate, I spurn your festivals and smell no fragrance in your convocations. I mean, this is pretty good. This is pretty good sermonizing here. This is an author at The Atlantic quoting a prophet of God saying that all of your traditions, your festivals, your convocations, they're not godly at all. They're just based on human reasoning, human traditions, the traditions of men. God does say, he's quoting from Amos 5. God does say, I despise your feast days. I despise your solemn assemblies. I despise your carnal worldly traditions. Yes, indeed. That's Amos 5 and verse 21. They weren't divine institutions. They weren't divine convocations. They weren't God's festivals. They were days that God despised. They were days that sprung celebrations, that sprung from ancient Babylon. That's what God communicates through his prophets of old, through Amos, through Jeremiah at the gates of Jerusalem, through the prophet Ezekiel. Let me just continue on with, I'll break away from the article for a moment to quote a few more verses. Amos 5, verse 22, it says, though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. You make offerings? You make sacrifices? You have a show of religion? God says, I don't accept your offerings. I don't accept your religion. It says, neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts, it says. Take you away from me. Take you away from me, the noise of your songs, your singing, your celebrations, all of your forms of worship. God says, take it away, for I will not hear the melody of your vials, but let judgment run down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. This is what the author of this piece at The Atlantic wants. He wants judgment to run down on our waters, the Republican waters, the Trump administration, certainly not his side, everybody at The Atlantic. I mean, they're as pure as the driven snow. He writes here, this author, at its core, the David comparison is, in fact, sacrilegious. That's not right. Cursed be the man who trusts in humans and makes mortal flesh his strong arm. That's quoting Jeremiah 17. That's a verse we've referred to over and again. You are under a curse if you're following a man, whether it's Barack Obama or President Trump or anyone else. That's a lesson God's been trying to drill into our thinking from the beginning of human civilization. If you put your trust, your faith in a man, you come under a curse. You think this author at The Atlantic is trusting in the God of this universe? Supposing he does take great exception with this administration and its policies, do you think he's looking to God to sort it out? He says the worship of power or of wealth is an affront in the eyes of the Bible to the master of the universe. It sounds pretty eloquent, pretty religious. It says it's a perversion of Scripture to use it to celebrate a king or indeed a president, and particularly one whose character
is flawed beyond repair. There is no fixing this president. He is flawed beyond repair. Everybody knows it. Everybody sees it. Everybody at the Atlantic, everyone on the editorial board, they certainly know. He's flawed beyond repair. And so to make the comparison, it's sacrilegious. You should be sounding the alarm. Okay, well, remind me to come back to the Atlantic. When Ezekiel 4 and 5, when that's happening on the streets of America, and God's people, God's church, is sounding the alarm, I wonder what this particular journalist will be saying then. He says, what the David analogizers are unintentionally showing us is how swiftly religion used to serve the ends of politics becomes twisted and corrupted. We see this corruption of religion in its more monstrous forms in places like the Islamic Republic of Iran, but in a small way, it's felt in the United States today by preachers who celebrate unrepentant sinners. He's claiming that these men of religion are using the Bible to serve their political aims. And in fact, that's what he's doing. It's politics. That's their religion. Left-wing ideology. That's their religion. And as long as Obama's people are in office, hey, it's tranquility. It's peace. It's utopia. You have the Messiah. He's here. You have everything that you need. And as soon as a Republican takes over, well, then the lefties start quoting from Amos, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. They want more judgment. They want more rage. They want more fiery rebuke. He says it was part of the genius of the founders of the United States that they understood that by acknowledging religion yet prohibiting its establishment, they were enhancing its moral power. Now listen to this statement, because again, you'll have to remind me to check back with the Atlantic when Ezekiel 4 and 5 are happening. We're in the early stages, but when it's full blown, it'll be interesting to see what the Atlantic is writing then. But it says here, when the faithful draw on their belief to help us see evil for what it is, to mobilize our consciences and to steel our hearts to fight against it, to fight against evil. It says they make their country stronger. Well, that's true, actually. If we're denouncing the evil and doing everything that we can to fight against it, through repentance, obviously, then that will make the nation stronger. That will make the nation healthier. No doubt about it. The problem, though, is that as other prophets bring out, Hosea 4 says as much, God has a controversy with all the inhabitants of the land, right and left. He has a controversy with all of the sins of the land. The sins that we're indulging in and actively promoting. Read Hosea 4 and verse 1. Or to stay in Amos 5, that's what this author is referring to, a prophecy in Amos 5, verse 25 in Amos chapter 5. It says, have you offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But you have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch and Chion, your images, the star of your God, which you made to yourselves. You've erected these idols, these false gods like Moloch. Here's this man's conclusion, Elliot Cohen. He says at the Atlantic, when the faithful draw on their belief, I read this part earlier, when they draw on their belief to help us see evil for what it is, to mobilize our consciences and steel our hearts to fight against it. They make their country stronger when they use it to excuse, or worse, glorify their political patrons. They are, as it were, building altars on the high places to Baal and bringing the souls of their followers that much closer to the fires of Moloch. It's a pretty good Bible study coming from the Atlantic. It's a shame, though, that he sees this as only applying to Donald Trump. In fact, this is for all of us in the United States. Verse 27 of this passage, Amos 5, it says, "Therefore will I cause you to go into captivity beyond Damascus, says the Eternal, whose name is the God of hosts." It's interesting, isn't it, that this author is taking us through a prophecy in the book of Amos, of all places. Amos 5, and then you get into chapter 6, God says, "Woe unto them who are at ease in Zion, who feel secure on the mountain of Samaria." They feel secure. They feel safe. God says, "Woe unto them, because destruction is coming. Captivity is coming." That's Amos 6. And then Amos 7, you have a fascinating prophecy about an end-time Jeroboam, a very religious leader, and yet one who, just like the Jeroboam of old, one who rebels against the house or the throne of David. And that leads to a confrontation between the leader of Israel, or the United States today, and God's anointed, God's prophet, God's apostle, God's king. That is yet to be fulfilled, the confrontation, that is. But we're certainly in the Jeroboam end. Perhaps this writer over at the Atlantic will continue on in his study so that he can get through Amos 6 and then Amos 7. Of course, there's even more to learn from the rest of that book, the famine of the word in Amos 8. You read all about the raising of the ruins work in chapter 9. So he doesn't quite hit the nail on the head with all of his scriptural analysis, but we can help to fill in the gaps on this program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. When the British government gave the Stone of Destiny back to Scotland in 1996, it captured media headlines around the world. But none of the reporting explained the God-inspired history of Britain's Stone of Destiny. This incredible true story is told in Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Nothing embodies the history and prophecy of the British peoples quite like Britain's Stone of Destiny. Yet many have forgotten this vital history. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm. For more information, visit our website, thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Just a quick follow-up to the story we had yesterday, or the segment on the global unrest, the protests. We focused in on Iraq in particular, had those clips from the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi, who was saying that, Well, he was just giving some of the details and how that people are rising up in defense of freedom, or that's what they're crying out for. That's what they want. The New York Times yesterday had a piece about the deadliest political unrest in Iran since the Islamic Revolution 40 years ago. Iran, of course, clamped down on it right away, closed off the internet to keep the story from ever seeing the light of day. But some of those details are now beginning to trickle out. And we don't know if the Iranian government's killed 200 people or maybe 600, 800 or more. We just don't know. It says here in the Times, it began 2 weeks ago with an abrupt increase of at least 50% in gasoline prices. And then, of course, within a few hours, there were all these outraged demonstrators spilling into the streets. It says, in many places, security forces responded by opening fire on unarmed protesters, largely unemployed or low-income young men. It says further on, the recent use of lethal force against people throughout the country is unprecedented. Further on, altogether from 180 to 450 people and possibly more were killed in 4 days of intense violence after the gasoline price increase was announced on November 15th. So just 4 days, and they killed upwards of 200 people, maybe 450 or more. Violent protests across the country. That's what we now know. It says here, the last enormous wave of protests, that was in 2009. Of course, that's when Barack Obama, when he was supporting all kinds of uprisings around the world in the early years of his presidency, he didn't do much of anything to support the Green Revolution. It says, only now, nearly 2 weeks after the protests were crushed and largely obscured by an internet blackout in the country that was lifted recently, have details corroborating the scope of killings and destruction started to dribble out. And so there are more press reports commenting on this, but even there, they're focusing in on the high gas prices or the Iranians' desire for cheaper food or whatever it is. But this other journalist here writing at The Hill says, anyone who thinks that the recent protests in 100 cities throughout Iran are about gas prices did not pay attention to what the protesters were saying. The immediate spark that led to the Arab Spring, well, it refers back to some of that history from a few years ago, but it says Iranian protesters and rioters chanting no to Gaza, no to Lebanon, leave Syria, and think of us, and even death to Palestine. These are some of the chants among the Iranian protesters. It indicates that something much larger than the price of gas drove their outrage. They're saying to their government, look, forget the terrorism in Lebanon, in Gaza. Leave Syria and look after our people. Help our people. There's people in the streets of Iran saying, Iran first. They're taking the president's cue. How about showing a little extra attention to your own citizens? Well, that, as I say, is a bit of a follow-up to what we discussed yesterday. You can listen to that podcast from yesterday at thetrumpet.com. One other item here, it ties in with the TV watching. This is a survey that is finding or has found that many middle-aged people just give up on working out once they reach the age of 40 or I think 41. It says 2 in 5 respondents now admit that they feel too old to get back in the gym. In fact, the survey of 2,000 adults found that on average, the age when most in the survey felt too old to work out regularly was just 41 years of age. 41 is pretty young, at least to me it is. 41 years of age, and by that point they're like, that's enough. I've had enough. I can't get to the gym. The most common barrier, it says here, not having time. Modern work pressures get in the way of fitness and health, it says. for many. Well, the truth of it is we're just, as a whole, our society is becoming much more sedentary. And this other survey that I mentioned at the top of the show, new research reveals people watch about 3.5 hours of television each day on average. Six of ten adults admit that they would be lost without their TV. They would not know what to do without a television. That's the world of today. I mean, this is incredible. Listen to this. Of course, all of those hours are undoubtedly adding up. This is talking about the daily average. And a recent survey of 2,000 British adults finds that the average TV viewer will watch an astounding 78,705 hours of programming. That's movies, sports, news, all of it, in their lifetime. Almost 79,000 hours. It says that's a whole lot of screen time that may have been better spent on more productive endeavors. How much is 70? If you have a calculator in there, how many hours, how many years is that? 79,000 hours. Hours after hours after hours. Wasting away our lives. It says on a day-to-day basis, the average adult watches TV for 3.5 hours, amounting to 1,248 hours each year. Well, that's the amount per year. 1,248 hours a year. It says here the survey commissioned by LE Electronics broke down these numbers even further and concluded that the average adult these days will watch 3,639 movies at home and 31,500 episodes of TV during their lifespan. I mean, you think this is a joke. I see here, if our calculator's right, 79,000 hours, that's 9 years of your life. 9 years of 24/7. If you are awake every minute of every day watching the television, on average, if you crammed it all into one successive binge watching, 9 full years of TV watching. Now, as I said yesterday, do you think we're in need of a little bit of quiet, solitary time? Communing with God? Talking with God in prayer? Abraham Lincoln, I read this quote yesterday. He lived with trees, with the bush wet with shining raindrops, with the burning bush of autumn, with the lone wild duck riding a north wind and crying down on a line north to south, the faces of open sky and weather, the axe, which is an individual one-man instrument. These he had for companions. Books, friends, talkers, chums of his endless, changing soliloquies. And we might add, that's a quote from Sandberg's book, no TV. How did he survive? How did he survive with no TV? What did he do with his time? What did he do with those extra 9 years? They didn't have TV, and, well, there's quite a few of them from that history that did fairly well. I mentioned that quote from Dershowitz yesterday, where he said that without the solitude of America's founding fathers, there would be no America. And we could add to that, without the solitude of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, the prophet, without the solitude of Jesus Christ, there'd be no church of the living God today. There would be no work of God. Jesus Christ, the scriptures say, he got up a great while before day. He got up before everybody else got up so that he could go and find a private place and speak to God in prayer. Now, he was a very social being, Jesus Christ. You could say you might be able to say he was the most socially outgoing individual in history. Just constantly expressing godly love toward other people, serving others, healing others, teaching others, loving others. He was so popular, or at least so many people wanted to hear him and talk to him and have him pray for them, that he had to get up a great while before the day, before daybreak, so that he could talk to his Father and ours, our Father as well. We need time alone with God and with God's family. We need time alone with our Bibles. You think about the number of hours per year, 1,248 hours each year. That's what 3.5 hours a day amounts to. Now, if you're really humming along at a spiritual clip, praying to God for an hour a day, even that only amounts to 365 hours per year. It's not even close. It's not even close to the amount of TV time that we spend on average watching the movies, watching the sitcoms, watching sports events. Spend time getting to know, really knowing your companions in the Spirit, God the Father, Jesus Christ, His Son, the inspired Word of God, the Holy Bible. You know, and some of this I'm going to use here in a moment at the forum, but just in reading a little bit from the prayer years about the teenaged Abraham Lincoln, his education essentially started with the Bible. His mom read it to him before she died when he was 8, I guess it was. But his stepmother, she continued in that same vein. But he had very little formal schooling, Abraham Lincoln. When he was in his mid-teens, he knew the alphabet. He knew how to read a little bit, but it was difficult for him to just read at 15. He was a backwoods pioneer. He was an outdoorsman. He worked. And he didn't acquire a love for reading until his mid-teens. And at that time, he didn't even know how to write. This is Abraham Lincoln, perhaps one of the most eloquent orators in U.S. history, perhaps the deepest thinker in American history, the history of America's presidents anyway. He got a little bit of schooling at the age of 15, and that really lit a fire. All total, I think he had about 12 months of schooling. Today we get 9 years of TV. Abraham Lincoln had about 12 months or 1 year of formal schooling. But during that time, he developed a love for reading, and that became a lifelong habit, a passion, in fact. And as I say, it all started with the Bible. Dale Carnegie says this in Lincoln the Unknown, the ability to read opened up a new and magic world for him, a world he had never dreamed of before. It changed him. It broadened his horizon and gave him vision. And for a quarter of a century, reading remained the dominant passion of his life. This is what he did, those many hours that he had available for leisure. He was reading and studying. Carnegie says the boy pored over these priceless treasures. He kept the Bible and Aesop's Fables within reach and read them so often that they profoundly affected his style, his manner of talking, his method of presenting arguments. Of course, he went on to become a lawyer in his late 20s. A lawyer who was grounded in the Bible. Imagine that. He read the Bible so often that it had a profound impact on his lifestyle, on his manner of speech, on his method of presenting arguments. That's pretty amazing when you think about the impact that his Bible study, this is someone that wasn't even in the true church of God. He really wasn't even associated with formal religion that I know of. He went to church a few times. But he knew the Bible. In a carnal, secular sense, he knew the Bible. Listen to what he said at the age of 23. He was campaigning for the Illinois State Legislature. Here's a 23-year-old who said that everyone in Illinois, everyone in the country, should have at least a moderate education, enough to study the histories and the scriptures. Everyone needs at least that much to be able to study history and the Bible. If you can do that, then you're on your way. Lincoln said, "For my part, I desire to see the time when education, and by its means, morality, sobriety, enterprise, and industry, shall become much more general than at present." That's Abraham Lincoln writing in 1830 or thereabouts about the need for a higher standard of morality. A 23-year-old campaigning for office on that platform. Hey, we need to keep our nose in the scriptures, everybody. And by the way, I stand for upgrading or upping the standard of morality around these parts. What an impact those early studies had on the one who would become the 16th president of the United States of America. Paul said to Timothy, I alluded to this yesterday, he said, "Let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Until I come, give attendance to reading," it says, "to exhortation, and to doctrine." So find that balance, Paul said to Timothy. Be an example. Be an example in your conduct, in the way you communicate with others, in the way that you show love toward people. But then make sure too that you spend a lot of time in a solitary place, alone with God's word, alone with God's truth. And give attendance to reading, and give attendance to Bible study, to exhortation, to doctrine. It says in Sandberg's book that Lincoln was always reading and thinking. That's the way one boss summed it up. One supervisor that he had said, that boy is always reading, and he's always thinking. Where would we be as a nation without these kinds of individuals? Where would we be as God's church without Jesus Christ and Abraham and the Apostle Paul and Peter and the prophets Ezekiel and Micah and Jeremiah and even Amos, the prophet Amos, who said about our nations and all of the idolatry that's just rampant, and the so-called religion of our day, the religion of Jeroboam, you could say. God says, I don't accept your sacrifices. I don't accept these spiritual offerings. I don't accept these convocations, these traditions that you've established. I want for you to obey me, to keep the days I make holy, Holy? Well, there's a lot. There's a lot that we can do with 9 years of TV time. It's not that all TV viewing is wrong, but we certainly need to be doing a lot of other things, and so much the more as we see the day of Jesus Christ's return approaching. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.